to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer. With me is... He's a recent immigrant. He has a bit of an elbow problem, if you know what I'm talking about. And he's a local cow man at this farm here.
Local cow man. I'm just you know, I'm just looking for a woman that'll serve me some coffee on Sunday mornings, that's all. And I have a mysteriously much younger than I should son. Okay, so you were saying I was an alcoholic? Is that what I was hearing?
Yeah, okay. I'm saying you're an alcoholic and you're a cow man.
Yeah, I have sex with cows. Yeah, I get it. Wait, that's not what you're saying. I don't even know. They hired those guys directly on to work with the cows, so they had to sleep in the barn also. That's not fair.
Well, they're immigrants. That's what they deserve.
I guess. Where was everyone else sleeping?
They had like servants' quarters.
Oh.
Slave quarters, basically.
Fresh off the boat, I guess you get what you get.
Yeah. So, we're talking about Pele the Conqueror. It's based off of a book from 1910, I believe. And it's the Cannes winner of 1988. It came out in Denmark in 87, but premiered, I guess, like, officially or whatever in Cannes. I don't know how these release dates work, but it's the 88 winner for Cannes. And it debuted in America in December 31st of 88.
Yeah, I think even if a film had been made like within a certain year period, it could still be entered into the running as like that country's entry or a thing.
Yeah.
Something so like that. It's like, the 88 winner.
Imamura's Ballad of Narayama was like a couple of years before it went to Cannes and won. In 80, whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, so, Pele the Conqueror. I don't know how I first heard about this movie, but, I somehow came across it, and I saw, like, is Max von Sydow, and I was like, I don't know, it just sounded interesting, and I've been looking for an excuse to watch it. I've been hoping it'll show up on streaming at some point. And, yeah, so I had an excuse to finally watch this movie I've been curious about for a few years.
See, I'd never heard of it before at all. But,
I think I was looking up, like, what one can every year, and that title really stuck out to me for some reason.
I don't know. Pele, first of all, it's not about a soccer player. Disappointing.
No.
Although he, as far as I know, he was the conqueror, right, of all soccer?
Yeah, he made soccer a thing in America, apparently.
Yep. Before Pele, there was nothing. But this is about some Swedish kid who goes to Denmark and
has a tough experience growing up.
It was like a young adult novel, like, that at least that's the way I was viewing it, like this from the point of view of the kid and him having to grow up and see grown-ups act the way they do because he's poor and they're poor and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the whole setting felt like a microcosm of like trying to like symbolizing this is Denmark in the era, because like the whole I don't know all of Denmark's history, but like it definitely felt like commenting on the country in that point in time. Because like the whole like the immigration from Sweden, so something's happening in Sweden, and like I feel like there's a lot of historical context. If you're Swedish or Danish, you pick up on it, but if you're not, it's kind of the sense of there's something more going on. I just don't know the details of what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if it was supposed to be representative of the bigger culture. Like, I think this was probably just a snapshot of the world right then, or maybe not right then. Like, a piece of history that people weren't talking about, like immigrants from Sweden all, you know, going to Denmark. There was, like, a huge amount of immigrants just on that day, but people were, like, waiting for them to show up so that they could haul them away to their farms or whatever.
Yeah, it was, like, I wouldn't call this, like, a tragedy porn, but it kind of, you know, it veers a little bit into territory, but still has, like, a sense of lightness.
Like a Bergman film.
Yeah.
But no symbolism, you know, it just seems like it's a slice of this person's life.
Yeah, the book was published in four volumes.
Four volumes?
Boyhood is what this movie is based off of. It's 1906. Apprenticeship is the next volume, 1907. Oh. The Great Struggle is 1909. And the final one is Daybreak in 1910.
I see.
And so it's the life of this child.
That's interesting to
me. Yeah, I want to read the whole series now. Mm. But, like, it kind of on paper, you would think this is like an Oscar bait movie, like an award bait movie. But then it goes into, like, dark and kind of outrageous areas, and it's like, okay, this is not trying for that at all. At least I felt like certain moments kind of derailed that momentum of, like, oh, this isn't trying to be super classy.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about the movie in general?
I like it overall. I have opinions on it. There's stuff that I feel like if this were an American movie, we have heard about it.
I'm not sure. I feel like this is almost a movie that we would have heard in the sense of, like, it was up for a bunch of awards or something like that, but it would have been, like, forgotten and tucked away, you know, after it had its moment in the sun. Because, like, I also enjoyed it, and it reminded me of a bunch of other movies that I've seen not recently or anything like that, but
yeah,
this kind of, like, rough upbringing story going on there. But I wouldn't say that I thought there was anything necessarily special about it. And I don't want to sound too harsh. I just...
Yeah, I don't think it's trying to be necessarily, like, unique in that sense. I think it's just trying to adapt this, the first volume of this, like, epic novel, the series that in Denmark and Sweden, it's like their version of, I don't say Harry Potter, but, like, you know, it's a very popular and, like, historical, important, like, novel over there that, like, basically outside of that region, nobody really knows or, like, reads it.
Well, you think there would be more than one? I mean, there's two. I saw two adaptations. One of them looked like it was a TV movie that came out actually just the year before this one was made. So it doesn't seem like it was widely adapted. But the kid who played Pele, whatever his name is, Pele, in this movie, was actually named after the character in the book. So
yeah, which is crazy because, like, the director, Bill August, I'm not sure how you say it, but, like, he auditioned thousands of children and ended up picking this kid because he wasn't, like, a movie, like a showbiz kid, because he seemed like a serious, like, actor who took it seriously.
I really dig non-actors. I always wonder how that comes off in the language that they speak, because you know, what you and I both love Italian neorealism stuff, and that's full of non-actors, and to us it seems amazingly realistic. But I've seen American movies with non-actors, and it's just like, sometimes it's good.
Yeah,
but I think this kid does a pretty spectacular job.
Yeah, like it's like he grounds the movie. The movie is through his perspective almost entirely. You get some stuff with his dad playing Max von Sydow, but I like his performance. I looked up what this kid has also done, and he has done like three other things after this, and that's about it.
Yeah, you know, he's like Charlie Bucket. He became a dentist after that.
Yeah, I feel like maybe like he realized acting isn't something he wants to do.
I mean, there's some rough stuff that happens in this movie that his character is witness to. I wonder how much of that stuff actually happened in front of the actor. But or like how many of the things they had to explain, like for context, like towards the end of the movie when, you know, you get into this movie, you can pretty much tell we're not going to have a happy ride through this thing. You know, we're going to have ups and downs, but mostly downs. And there's a point where Max von Sydow is just walking around with a rope, and it's the only kind of rope that people ever hang themselves with. Like, no one's ever hung themselves with a different kind of rope, I think, in the history of filmmaking.
Yeah.
And he's just walking around, and the boy has to go over and take it from him. Like, you jackass, you're not gonna hang yourself.
Yeah, it's in like I don't know, I feel like subjecting a child to the. I mean, there's no straightforward plot. It's just kind of like vignette of, I think it's 2 years or so, or a year and a half. But like you see it season by season. It's just incidents and like and stuff builds to, you know, and there are a lot of plot lines and characters, and you get to know the environment, but like there's no central thing. But like there's like he's witness to early on he's humiliated by the trainee who is being I guess he's like right beneath the foreman.
Yeah.
In the
he's being trained for another facility or something like that.
Because, like, this felt... It's kind of like, you know, basically slavery. Because, like, they have to live there, and they have horrible conditions, and they, you know, have to do the hard labor that... Yeah.
This is an indentured servitude sort of thing, where they do get paid enough to, like, be able to do pleasant things, but there's no chance they're ever going to have enough money to, like, leave... Even though the character Eric in this movie is talking about, like, oh, yeah, when I get enough money in 2 years. So I think you're right. It was 2 years. I'm going to go off to America. And then something happens to him. I don't know what happens to him, but...
Yeah, I guess, like... okay, so we should kind of put some stuff in context. There is... some stuff I don't think you can get away with in an American movie. Like the child nudity.
I
don't think you could do that in an American movie.
There was child nudity in the first Superman movie.
There was?
Yes. When Superman as a baby first appears, when his pod crashes, he comes out of the pod with his little noodle hanging out there. Some point, having any sort of child nudity on screen became just like too taboo, and I think we all know the real reason why, but it's because the government's trying to keep us away. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. It's not like a prude, but it's a strange thing to have on screen.
Well, it feels strange now. Like I think it wouldn't have felt so strange, especially at that time period. But my first thought in that part where the assistant or whatever the apprentice guy takes him into that barn, closes his doors, I'm like, oh my god, I'm about to see this kid get raped. I don't want to see this. And then sure enough, somebody comes up and like undoes his pants really quick. I'm like, oh my god, I'm like, oh come on, I guess we gotta hit the sadness. And it turns out that's not what happens. They're just going to humiliate him by opening the door, showing everyone his dingus, and then start smacking his butt with a whip. Ta-da. Okay. Yeah.
like it's undercutting like the classiness aspect of like, oh no, this will go there a few times, but it won't, you know.
Right. I think it that's like that underlies where the kid was sort of innocent before, and the more these things happen to him, the more aggressive he becomes himself, especially with his drunk father being like, you have to stand up, you know, big talker, you have to stand up to these people. You can't just, you know, let it, make sure to, if somebody is mean to you, punch them first. And that will show them, you know, what cowards they really are. He can't stand by his own words. But the boy, you know, he's teaching the boy these lessons that are going to get him hurt and do.
Yeah, like in school, he's, you know, he's bullied because I think he's the only immigrant kid in school.
Well, they're acting like it, at least.
And like that, I'm surprised there were some links to school days with both deal with race in certain ways, race and identity, because like they are immigrants, and I feel Pele was in school acclimating to to Danish society like quicker and more naturally, more than his father, because father clearly, you know, he was like his outcast, and the only people who liked him were a few people he worked with, basically. And like there's this whole sense of like one of them is trying to fit into society of a different culture, another one, because like I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, I think that when it comes to Pele, he's trying to fit into the culture, but that's because his father's telling him that's going to make their lives so much easier, and his father's not telling him, by the way, you're going to be treated like crap because we're actually immigrants, and people don't like immigrants in general. It doesn't matter where you're from. Like, you look exactly like the boy sitting next to you, but they know that your father is very poor and you live in a barn and all this stuff like that. And there's so many ways they're going to judge you. But hey, go to school, you know, work hard, be nice to the older women, because usually they're suckers for kids like you. And eventually we're going to make it. When in reality, he's probably been stomped down so many times himself, probably based on the same idea that he had trying to give this kid, that he's now an alcoholic. And constantly complaining, like, I'm so old, I can't do this, I can't do that.
Yeah. Did you like Max's performance?
You find me a movie Max von Sydow is bad in. I haven't seen it yet. And I watched freaking,
Shutter Island?
Huh?
Shutter
Island? No, I wasn't going to say Shutter Island. I was going to say the movie where they go into people's dreams.
Dreamscape.
Yes, Dreamscape. Which is not a good movie, but Max von Sydow just fine in it.
Oh, is he the villain?
No, he's actually a good guy.
Oh,
but
weird.
Yeah.
I was looking up some reviews for this, and some reviews brought up that von Sydow was in other Swedish immigrant movies. In two in the 70s, one called The New Land, about a Swedish family that comes to Minnesota, and the other was The Immigrants, which is an identical story. Mm-hmm. And so Ebert said like there are some loose connections of like to between the three movies, but I do find it interesting that von Sydow has been in at least three movies playing a Swedish immigrant trying to adjust to the culture.
Yeah, I wonder what launched him into like a international stardom type thing, because like he was in a bunch of American stuff on top of being famous for the Swedish films he was in. Like I guess he went farther into Europe, you know, because this was a Danish production, right? So even then, that wasn't from his home country.
I think it was Denmark and Sweden may have co-produced.
Probably. They're all in cahoots together, I tell you.
Yeah. I'm looking, maybe Exorcist was his big American thing.
I mean, that's what I know him from. And, of course, The Last Jedi. No, wait, not The Last Jedi. Sorry, The Force Awakens. When he's in the movie for about 3 minutes.
What else? I'm looking at, like, maybe Flash Gordon was, like, the big one, because he's not in The Exorcist that much. Wait, who's the guy? Who's the guy in the beginning in the Iraq segment?
That's Max von Sydow.
Okay,
Max von Sydow is The Exorcist.
So it must be like Flash Gordon, where he's Emperor Ming. Was that a hit movie?
Flash Gordon was huge bomb.
He Conan the Barbarian.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Strange Brew.
Oh, Strange Brew. That's where he took off.
Yeah, but he is sporadically in like American and Western stuff.
Yeah, I know. I'm really happy that he's been in all the things he has been. Don't be mad at me, Max.
Let's see. Did you like how everything looked? Did you like the cinematography, set design, all that stuff?
I think it was all lovely looking, you know, for even things like the farm, you know, or the house yard. I think everything looked really nice, but I think that's a general reflection on the country. Sorry. It looks a lot like other movies that are made in that area. And I don't think anything flashy was necessarily done with the camera style or anything. It's really based around the boys acting and kind of Max von Sydow. But I think he's definitely could have been a breakout star if he had wanted to continue to do movies after that.
Yeah, because like aside from the humiliation, there was him beating his friend.
Oh, yeah, my favorite character, like Rude.
Really, which is a deeply upsetting scene, but like it makes sense because like that was his only outlet of frustration because of how, I mean like it certain ways this movie I say it's a lot isn't subtle,
yeah,
and like that, like him laying out his frustration on his friend is was a tough thing to sit through, in
mood. Yeah,
clearly regretted it immediately.
Yeah, but they were still friends afterwards, which is, I guess you got to take what friends you can get. But nobody was picking on Lude, and even though he was I guess he was dumb because later there was a part where they were showing him in school, and he didn't know any of the answers to the questions.
Yeah, he was the headmaster's
bastard
son.
Yeah, yeah. What is the name of that guy?
Kongstrup.
Crazy lady who comes in. Kongstrup! You gotta give me some money, Kongstrup! Like, seriously, lady. You can't just walk into somebody's yard. Kongstrup! Okay.
Yeah, I like that Kongstrup is the... has no standards. He will fuck any woman.
Well, who knows? Who knows what she looked like 12 years ago?
That's true, but it seemed like he was like any woman who was available was A-okay.
Yeah.
And like he's seen wearing red, and red, you know, is a aggressive color, a color of anger.
Yeah,
and it's like, yep, I get what's going on here, and it's also the color of blood.
It's also the color of horniness. Because that guy was horny all the time.
Yeah, and then he gets his dick cut off by his wife or mistress.
Yeah, I don't know if it's cut off, but it's at least cut in a way. Yeah, later we see him relaxing on that couch. He just starts laughing his ass off.
And he's getting a little drugged up there. Yeah, but in that scene, the mistress is wearing red, so like the power has shifted.
Oh.
I like that little subtle thing. Mm. But man, I feel like there's a political allegory to some degree that us as Americans aren't really getting because we don't know the politics.
Yeah, I wouldn't get it. Yeah.
But,
I'm looking at the Wikipedia article. That guy Eric I was talking about, who is pretty good mm-hmm. on the accordion when he, you know, feels like it.
Yeah,
he kept saying like we're gonna visit America, China, and Negroland. I was like, what the hell is Negroland?
Yeah, I guess that's Africa.
It says here, Negroland or Negritia was an archaic term in European mapping describing inland and by Westerners poorly explored regions in West Africa as an area populated with Negro people. Yep.
Yeah, I saw that too. I'm like, oh. That's an old-timey term I haven't come across yet.
No. The to go off the subject here, I'm listening to the third Ice and Fire book, and mm-hmm. they keep using the word that even though it's not supposed to be the one that means somebody's being cheap, but has the N-word in it. You know what I'm talking about?
Are you serious?
Uh-huh. It's in the book? It says it in the book. I've heard it at least 3 or 4 times, and each time it's like a cold splash of water in my face. Like, oh. Like, hey, George R. R. Martin. I know these are like fantasy characters, and some of them are hillbillies, but stop it.
Do black people even exist in that world? I watched the first 2 seasons. I think saw 2.
They do, just not in the main land, basically. They're all located, like, Dorne or across the Narrow Sea.
Okay. I believe you on that. I will never read those books, probably.
I won't either. That's why I listen to audiobooks. I was going to say something about... What was I going to say?
Was it Max von Sydow and he's Demolition Man? Or is he Judge Dredd?
He's in Judge Dredd. He's not in Demolition Man.
Okay.
Yeah. Never. You know, he's good in... He's just fine in Judge Dredd. That's another dog shit movie. That's like... if I had to choose between Demolition Man and Judge Dredd, Demolition Man all the way. But...
Well, I mean, yeah. The Three Seashells. Come on, everybody knows how 3 seashells work.
Yeah. They're like buttons on the wall. You don't have to do anything crazy with them. They're not actual seashells. Jeez.
Yeah. How do I go with this? The costumes in this were... like, it kind of felt theatrical a bit. Mm-hmm. With, like, it taking place in one setting. And... I didn't do too much research, but maybe I feel like this may have been adapted into a play because I feel like this material could be translated to the stage because
mm-hmm.
very much just it's incidental and it's like this gives an excuse to have multiple scenes of people walking in and out and whatnot.
Mm.
But like the whole thing felt like a play because you have the big house of Kongstrup, and you have like the servants' quarters, and you have the barn.
Oh, this won best foreign language film in 89 ceremony too. By the way,
it won? Yeah. Okay, because 88 the winner was the Almodovar movie.
Yeah, it was the year after that for some reason.
Yeah, I don't get how these dates work.
Mm.
Release dates work. This was a Christmas release in Denmark.
Yeah, it's like a girl with a dragon tattoo, you know? Only the best at Christmas time.
Yeah.
See, that was there's these like little funny scenes in it. Like there was a Christmas scene in here where Maxwell mm-hmm. and Saito and Pele I can't say it other. I'm just going to call him Pele. Get dressed up in their best clothes because they're going to have Christmas dinner when they get downstairs. Eric is down there.
He's like, we're going to have pork with rice. Yeah, not rice. Pork with raisins in
who
it.
Who knows? They're going to make us something delicious. And yeah, down there, it's the usual mackerel. And Eric is pissed.
Yeah, I like Eric. He's a good... like a good side character, good like a little agent of chaos, because mm-hmm. I feel like the dad plants, you know, certain ideas in him, but like Eric is the one who's like, oh no, these plans can really happen, like it's actually possible.
Yeah, he's got hope. And,
like at a certain point,
he's got strength.
Yeah, like Eric kind of becomes the. Kind of a surrogate dad to an extent.
Yeah, like I mean, Pilot loves him, you know, and hangs on his every word. What happens to him, in your opinion? Because after he decides he's had enough, he goes and tries to. Oh, never mind. Of course, I forgot what knocked him out in the first place. So
yeah, because like every time you saw the well, you would see the big rock, like. Counterbalance thing. It's like, well, clearly that's going to come into play at some point.
Yeah, how fucking crazy do you have to be to do that, guys? Why not just have a rope on the other end? Like, no, I'm going to... Somebody had to set up that huge rock in the first place.
I mean, like, it's... like, from the get-go, because the way they emphasized it, because I think the first time you see it is the two young lovers, Anna and... or Anna... I guess, and Nils. Yeah. And, like, also, in their interaction, because, like, Nils is the son of Konstrup, I think?
No, he's the son of other rich person who was there visiting.
I was not sure where, but, like, whose kid he was. But, like, him and the girl who is, I guess, like, a laborer, in their actions, and... they never speak to each other. It's just exchange of looks.
Yeah,
and it's
at least
very nice.
Not like, that we
touch.
See.
Yeah, but when they're with Pele, they actually speak to him.
Right.
And it's this strange thing of like when they're together, there's nothing. But when they speak to the what's the word the
protagonist
the character. No, the character represents the audience.
Oh, the character who represents the audience is what it's called. No, I don't know.
I feel like there's another word for it.
There probably is some sort of literary term that I don't know.
Yeah, but like when I talk to him, it's like it's just interesting that they speak to the person who's you know who we are experiencing the movie through.
Right.
And it's like okay, now I kind of know more about their story. Because they're telling it like directly to Pele, so by default they're telling it directly to an audience.
And we can infer. I mean, we didn't even need that necessarily. We could infer what's going on. They like you said, this movie is not subtle. It's pretty blatant about that stuff. And speaking of not subtle, Sarah caught this one part that I was watching, wherein, of course, Nils gets Anna pregnant. And we don't see her have the baby, but we see what happens to the baby because some women are washing their clothes in the river and one of them suddenly screams and you get a clear shot of a dead baby in the water. And I laughed so hard because it was out of nowhere and hilarious to me. Like, I could not help it.
It's a...
like I
that's one of that.
Yep.
I don't want to nitpick, but the baby didn't look that realistic.
No.
But maybe if it was in the water for a while, their skin would change.
Yeah, maybe it's a little
bloaty.
But
it still was it was horrific, but also just so bizarre and like random. Not random, because you kind of knew something was going to happen.
Right, you knew something bad was going to happen because of the nature of the movie and what had, you know, you knew the Anna and Nils weren't together. But I just couldn't help it. Like, ah, dead baby! Like, I don't, yeah. I guess I'm a bad person is what I'm saying.
I jumped, but I kind of giggled a little bit, because it's not as bad as the baby in that Clint Eastwood movie, the sniper one.
Now, see, I haven't seen that, but yeah, I've seen pictures of that mutant.
I've seen the clip of the baby, and man, I don't understand how Clint thought that was okay, but I'm not Clint Eastwood, so who knows?
I don't know, he's never had a baby before, he doesn't know what they look like.
the guy who has like 10 kids. Mm-hmm. Doesn't know what babe looks like.
He constructed those kids out of air. It's not the same thing.
That's true. He was fucking for a long time. His youngest kid is younger than me. I'm in my late 20s. Mm-hmm. So he's been keeping busy.
Oh, well, you got to have something to do.
Yeah.
Not make any more noticeable movies, but you might as well keep on doing it.
American Sniper is noticeable for certain reasons.
Speaking of doing it, why are the men in this movie so horny?
Well, because there's nothing to do. You work. There's no entertainment. They can't read. A lot of them can't read.
Yeah, we talked about the whoever owns the property, and he's obviously stepping out on his poor wife, who seems like a very nice woman and is very nice to Pella the entire time. And even to the point where... his wife brings her niece over to live with them for a while, and of course he's immediately got eyes for her, and takes her maidenhood. And we don't see that getting taken, but the aftermath is graphic enough when she's trying to wash the bloodstain out of her dress.
And he's just sitting there smoking a cigar. Yep,
he's like, "Huh, well, I didn't know you were going to make such a big mess," but he gets his, which is fine. But even Max von Sydow, you know, finds a lusty old widow.
And their whole scene together is pretty funny because they're so matter of fact about it.
It was great. Like, oh man, I don't even, because he just goes over to thank her for helping his son. She's like, you know, I could use a good man. Yeah, well, my wife died. I haven't seen my husband. He might have died at sea. You know, I wouldn't mind occupying a bed. Yeah, eat this food. That's how you know about a man. Okay, you're staying over tonight. Okay, I guess I am. And so he did.
And she lays down and he starts taking off his overall. And it's like, oh, he's getting something.
You know, something's happening. Somebody's got to warm that bed. He got cleaned up for a reason.
Yeah, like the other woman earlier denied him, but then they become friends. Mm-hmm. I think it's the same woman. Like, some of them kind of blend together, the ones who aren't as prominent. Like, Eric stuck out, definitely, because, who the fuck look like? He looks like some other actor I can't think of offhand.
To me, he kind of looked like that guy who... never mind, I'm totally blanking on it. But yeah, he does look like somebody else.
Yeah, he died 2 years ago. Mm. His final film was Kingsman, The Golden Compass, The Golden Ring, whatever.
That's the second movie? Okay.
Yeah, second movie. And he played the King of Sweden, because you probably know the joke at the end of the first one is... The guy gets to butt fuck the princess of Sweden.
On the version I saw. Yes, I understand. Yeah, that's horrific. I still like those movies.
I haven't seen them. I find Mark Millar extremeness kind of annoying.
Yeah, I mean, Watchmen is a fucking awful goddamn movie.
Watchmen?
Or not Watchmen, sorry. Whatever. Wanted.
Kick-Ass?
Watchmen is also not that good.
Watchmen is a good book.
No, it's a great book. It's an amazing book. And it's the most droll, dry, movie adaptation you could ever do. It's like, and then on page 2 this happens, and then page 3, oh, don't get too excited, page 4 is coming up.
And we're going to exactly recreate as close as possible.
Isn't this blue penis shocking? Like, no, you don't really... I mean, I guess. Oh, look at it again, though. No, that's okay.
Like, the Kick-Ass movies, for me, aged pretty poorly in a couple years. And I was the perfect age for it at the time, and I didn't like it then.
I
liked Boondock Saints at the time, just to put things in perspective. And I was like, yeah, this one is kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But Boondock Saints.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat there. I was like, yeah, Boondock Saints is great. What is this Wanted bullshit? Yeah. So, what else? What else is there to say? The way the movie's laid out, like I said, reminds me of a young adult novel. Specifically, I was thinking of Bless Me, Ultima. And I'm sure there's other things that follow the same path, where it's just like I said, it's this slice of life, boy's life type thing, where these incidents happen that seem kind of like they might be a big deal to somebody else, but to him, it's just kind of like passing by. Like, there's that scene where they're, like, hauling in a boat of people who froze to death. Like, the entire boat is frozen with these frozen people in it.
Yeah.
And he's going, I think that's the one where he's going to go look at them, and the boys are like, you're not brave enough, you're a coward, you wouldn't even jump in the water. He's like, fuck you, and he jumps in the water like an idiot.
Yeah, that kind of foreshadows a later scene with the bullies at the water when they're, like, threatening to beat him with the sticks and they chase him off.
Yeah, why weren't they, like, applauding him after he did that? I was impressed.
Well, because he's a dirty Swede and his dad is a married woman, and that's enough to make fun of someone for.
True.
Oh yeah, there were a lot of shots in a lot of shots of people looking through windows to learn something pivotal or vital that would influence them later.
Mm-hmm.
So during a Christmas dinner when Eric causes a fuss because he's tired of eating herring, he's playing the accordion, and like Pelle sees him, you know, defying authority, and I see that as informing his later choices. And then you have the mistress realizing what happened between her niece and her husband while looking through a window. There's kind of like every time you would see a shot of someone looking through a window, it'd be something vital that would come up later.
Yeah, it's just like real life. Every time I look out the window, it's like, what the hell? Which is why I never do.
Yeah, but it's a really interesting little thing I kind of picked up on.
Yeah, it creates literal snapshots as opposed to, like I said, the slices we're seeing there. Like, you're seeing things from the other side of the glass. You can't really interact. And the one time that he tries to is at the end of the movie when we didn't actually say what happens to Eric. I mean, you watch the movie if you feel like it, but his head gets smashed by that giant rock at some point, and you're like, oh, this guy's dead.
And you think, and then you see him on the ground breathing. It's like, oh, shit, he's going to get tortured probably.
Yeah, I didn't know what the hell was going to happen.
And like the Kongstrup says, take him to the dungeon. The dungeon, the basement.
We're going to resurrect him.
Might as well be a dungeon. And it's like, oh, I guess he's going to be beaten nearly to death or poked and prodded.
Yeah, finish him off.
Stuff.
He essentially gave himself a whatchamacallit, a
lobotomy?
Yeah, that's what I was, the word.
Yeah, I thought it was, I wasn't sure because lobotomies weren't like that much of a thing yet.
Right. No, I don't think he got one. I think that his head being smashed that way gave him such a bad concussion. it like bruised his brain. Or he has PTSD. That's possible too. I would.
Yeah, there. Well, yeah, there are also a shit ton of wars in Europe at the time, so I'm sure some of them, you know, were veterans of some pointless war.
It says in the late 1850s. Yeah, I have no idea what was going on.
Maybe that's like, I think, Franco-Prussian War.
Mm.
I might be off by a couple decades.
That wouldn't have been touching them.
Yeah, no. I don't know, there's so much shit, so much European history there. It's complicated.
I wonder what was going on in Sweden that was making everyone immigrant.
I don't know, but when the mistress took over, I don't know why I thought this, but I kind of took that as a nod, kind of maybe to Queen Margaret II, who was, I think, the first female ruler of Denmark, and she at one point was, she's around during, she coexisted with Queen Elizabeth, the first one, and she, if you look up Queen Margaret II of Denmark, it's a different spelling of Margaret, but she was at one point ruler of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, and so she had like even more power than like Queen Elizabeth, being the queen of a single country.
Mm.
Her life is fascinating, but I feel like having like the woman take over was maybe influenced by that a bit. Potentially, but I could be talking on my ass. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's art. You can interpret it however you want.
Yeah.
As long as it's not racist.
Yeah. Well, like, Queen Margaret II is a very fascinating woman who I think should be more well-known outside of, like, Scandinavia.
Mm.
I think she was the only female regent to ever rule Norway. Because Norway had a rule of no women are allowed to be the sovereign ruler of the country.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Billy August, the director,
mm-hmm.
he won Cannes a second time for the Best of Intentions in 92.
I don't know anything about that movie.
I don't know. It's about Bergman. It's based off his life.
Oh, interesting.
I think it's about like his parents or something.
I did see he'd done some other movies I'd actually heard of, like House of the Spirits and what else? So the Les Miserables that has Liam Neeson in it.
Interesting.
Let's see.
He did a couple movies 2 years ago.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, that's the only thing I'm recognizing off the top there.
But, you know, he's still making movies. He's not getting the same attention he used to, but he's still out there making movies.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Have you seen Le Comte Lucien?
I don't know.
It's a Louis Malle film. And I thought the end was going to go in that direction because at the end of this movie, Pelé has gotten the favor of the woman that runs the household. And basically she's like, the apprentice is about to leave his position and I thought you should take it. And so they're like fitting him for his garments. And we've seen him kind of, like I said, he kind of gets into this, like, fight-back mode where, you know, people are bullying him verbally, but he is, like, physically taking it out. And the whole scene where he was whipping Hlud with that nettles branch. And in Le Comte Lucien, it's about this kid who is a bully already. And he's living in Normandy, when the Germans come in, and at first he's like working with the resistance because he just doesn't like, he's just doing whatever is in the flow, go with the flow type thing. But then he like starts working with the Nazis and, you know, the power goes to his head and stuff like that. He's a real piece of, yeah. I was like, are they going to, oh. Is that the way they're going to go with this kid?
I took that at him rejecting a trainee at job as like him rejecting potentially becoming that type of person.
Yeah. I wonder if the ending of the movie is true with the book because yeah. The second book you said is like called Apprenticeship or something.
Yeah. I know. I'm sure it's been translated. It seems to be a big enough deal.
Yeah.
But I know it's a recurring thing of like ships in the fog would only bring bad news. Because like there's bringing in the three dead bodies. There was them coming into a new world where, you know, they're just going to be treated like trash and be treated like, you know, the like slaves, basically.
There was that pretty awesome scene with Nils where he's decided he doesn't want to live anymore, but he goes out heroically, rows a boat yeah. out to this another immigrant boat because they pull off some Mongolian looking people. Where he rows out there, the boat's obviously going to sink, and he connects the line so that they can slide across to the shore.
And one guy saves his pet.
Oh, pig. Yeah, I was worried about that piggy.
Yeah, and he get in, you see it got a hole in
his pig. Like, my piggy, no.
But,
and then I think that yeah, the last ship, it depends on who you are, because, yeah, it's bad for Pele and his dad that the Olsen returns, but Mrs. Olsen's probably happy.
I guess. But. Yeah, but there's a whole, like, ships being, like, a bad omen of some sort. Mm-hmm. And the whole immigrant story thing, it reminds me a bit of my favorite movie of 2018, A Season in France, by Mohamed Salah Haroun. Mm-hmm. Which, this is kind of a similar thing of a immigrant family, but this is a family from Central African Republic moving to... Not moving to, they've been in France for a while, but they have to update their status. And like every Haroun movie, politics forcing a common person from Africa into making a tough decision that will kind of alter their lives in a significant way. And this is them kind of, this family dealing with trying to acclimate to French society / trying to like be full citizens and trying to navigate that whole thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's much sadder, but it has higher highs though. So it has lower lows but higher highs.
Yeah.
And if you want to feel devastated by a movie, watch A Season in France. It will definitely do that.
I don't wanna. No.
Yeah. But connections to school days, there's a de-virginizing someone.
Yeah. He certainly goes to school.
Yeah, there's school.
And the teacher and, hilariously dies.
Yeah. They both deal with history, because like when school days is kind of harkening to like Black history and like the civil rights leaders and all that,
mm-hmm.
and this is dealing with, you know, a different part of history and different place, but still, you know, rooted in history.
Yeah,
and they both deal with that, and like this deals with the haves and have-nots, where like School Days has like the scene of Samuel Jackson, clowning Lawrence Fishburne, and his friends. And like, that's a whole, like, them be like, yeah, well, you guys have a lot of shit, but we're a real local, so you kind of ruin everything. that whole scene. So
mm-hmm.
There are certainly some connections. I feel like Rain Man, I haven't seen it, but I feel like there won't be as much crossover.
I honestly don't know. I have a... yeah, I don't know.
But aside from that, I don't know. I enjoyed this movie. If you want to see Max von Sydow in something you haven't seen him in, watch this.
I enjoyed parts of the movie. I think it's a bit overly long, but it is based on a epic novel. Trying to adapt that into one movie is difficult to do. I think that it was a very well made movie. I think it's a good movie. I don't think I'll ever watch it again.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, pun intended. I don't know. It's not that it's so depressing. It's kind of like there isn't that much anything that special about it.
Yeah,
necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
And if I did watch Eternity in a Day, and that would have made a much better pair with He Got Game. They deal with like a father-son relationship. Both of them do, where like Eternity in a Day is kind of like an 8.5 type movie. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of self-reflexive of the director's career. I can't remember his name, the Greek director who died a couple of years ago, actually. But I don't know, like, Eternity Day is this very dreamy, and, like, it weaves in and out of, like, people telling stories, and you see a story, but it's, like, in one smooth shot, it'll go from the main character telling, like, this, the his surrogate son character being like, well, there's this poet in the Middle Ages, and then a camera will move as he's talking, and then you're suddenly in the Middle Ages, and you see, like, the story of the poet he's talking about, and it kind of weaves in between dreams and fantasies and stuff, and it's this very well-made, very touching movie that, by the end, there were a couple moments that almost got me.
Yeah, it sounds like it would have been a better pairing for sure.
Yeah, it's a better movie. I'd have a lot more to say about it than Shakespeare in Love.
I think we had a lot to say on Shakespeare in Love, surprisingly.
Yeah, surprise. Well, yeah, but I'd rather watch Eternity in a Day again, because that movie is wonderful. And I want to see other movies by its Greek director.
I don't.
Those movies are hard to see.
My general stance is I'd always rather watch something new than something I've seen before, even if it's something I really like. Just because I feel like watching something new, or watching something I've seen before, yeah, that's pleasing, and like there's a relaxation to knowing what's going to happen. But I feel like there is a figurative gap in my knowledge that I'm always trying to fill up and never will. So, yeah, I get that satisfaction from new movies.
I don't know if you've watched Eternity in a Day yet, but...
No, I haven't. I've got
also,
it.
Also, continuing the 8.5 connection, it stars Bruno Ganz, who is a phenomenal actor who died this year, or late last year. And his last movie was House That Jack Built. A movie that I personally like a lot, and if you don't like it, and you have seen it, I understand. If you don't like it, and you have not seen it, well, just watch it. It's Lars von Trier is actually a good artist. He's kind of a difficult person, but that's kind of his whole thing. He likes to be a difficult person. But Bruno Ganz took the part in Eternity Day because it was supposed to be Marcello Mastroianni from 8.5, but Marcello had died, I think, the year before.
He had died 7 years ago.
No, he is in that Altman movie, the fashion one that everyone says is terrible. I forgot what it's called. But yeah, so like, this really was trying to be like a real 8.5 situation, but you know, Marcello didn't live long enough.
Yeah.
So, for the New York Knicks, where is it? No, that's not it. Okay, I found it. February 10th, 1988, School Days was released. And that very next day, on February 13th, the Knicks played the Cavs. Knicks won 120-103. I think the Cavs is a home game. So, yeah, so it's Cavs at New York. And Knicks won that, and that season, that's the 87-88 season, so they were just under 500 and weren't very good. No, weren't as good that year. And then for what's this movie called that we just talked about? A Pelé to Conquer. That came out in America December 31st, 1988. And the day before that, Knicks played the Charlotte Hornets and lost 122-111. So that is this day in the New York Knicks.
Hooray!
Yeah, I've been forgetting those, so I want to make sure I get into the New York Knicks stuff.
I understand.
It's important to me.
It's important to Spike.
And I forgot to do it on the episode that we were released in a month or two. Yeah, we already recorded. Alright, so, what is this?
Huh? No.
Oh, yeah, alright. Other 88 movies?
Sure. There's an 88 movie, probably, that people have seen. So I'm just going to mention one, and then I'll have you do yours, and then I'll mention the ones that are on the Please Don't Send Me Out into Outer Space stuff. So if I had to pick one movie out of all the ones I've seen on 88 that I think are best represents what I'm all about, and hopefully this will not turn people away from listening, I have to say The Naked Gun. I've seen The Naked Gun.
That's respectable.
The first Naked Gun movie more than 30 times, probably. And I love the humor. I love the slapstickiness of it. I love the witty jokes of it. O.J. Simpson's in it, but you know what? He wasn't that O.J. Simpson when he made the movie. I think that Leslie Nielsen is one of the funniest people who ever lived. And Priscilla Presley does great in it, too. It's freaking Ricardo Montalban as the swarmy bad guy. And one of my personal favorite all-time character actors, George Kennedy, who I wasn't really...
He is in that movie.
Hmm?
I forgot he was in that
movie.
Oh,
yeah, he's in all three, I think. As the...
Yeah, I didn't know who he was until recently. So
exactly. See,
I'm sure...
When I saw these movies, I didn't know who he was. I thought, oh, it's that funny guy, you know? He's that guy, and he's the guy from the heartburn commercials. Or, no, I think they're garlic or something like that. But, I mean, he's been, like, when you look through his stuff, like, if I imagine my parents saw him in Police Squad and were like, what is George Kennedy doing in this movie? Because he's in so many other great things. And every time I see him, I'm like, yes, George Kennedy, freaking Spartacus and Cool Hand Luke and Charade and the Thunderbolt and Lightfoot anyways, Boston Strangler. I forgot about that. But yeah, I unabashedly love The Naked Gun and The Naked Gun 2.5. I haven't seen The Naked Gun 33 1/3. I think I'm okay.
Interesting. Well, for me, I have a couple picks. Recently, I decided to watch the Hellraiser movies that were on Shudder. So that was the first two. The second one came out in 1988. The first Hellraiser, I think, is good and interesting. And it sets up a weird, crazy world. And the second one, assumes you've seen the first one and just builds off of what the first one is. and this goes even crazier.
Yep.
And so the second one I like significantly more. It's it's Hellraiser. You know if you know what the series is about, you know what you're getting. And this is, from what I understand, like the last legitimately good one.
Yeah, I feel like Hellraiser 1 and 2, just like the original Halloween and Halloween 2, make a pairing of movies that you have to see together. I don't know. I think it's kind of an unpopular opinion for liking Halloween 2 for some reason. I happen to like Halloween 2 a lot. But Hellraiser 1 is a great must-see. Hellraiser 2 is the better movie, though.
Yeah, I can respect that. Let's see. My other one, I have a couple more. Bloodsport, which is a great action movie. And it's not the best Van Damme movie.
What's the best Van Damme movie?
I feel that's the one he did with Wilford Brimley.
Oh, Hard Target. Target. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I guess Lionheart is one that people say, but I haven't seen Lionheart. But I do love Bloodsport. But it's basically like Mortal Kombat the movie, and what the movie should have been, than what the crap that came out. But yeah, Bloodsport, it's exactly what you think it is, and it's great for being exactly what you think it is. John Waters' Hairspray, the final film he did with Divine. Divine died, I think, before it came out, or after it came out. But Divine didn't. I gotta look at when Divine actually lived to see it or not. Okay, it came out the month before he died. But Hairspray, it's pretty popular. You probably know, what the story is. You've probably seen a musical. Or the
remake.
The play or the movie. Yeah. It's everywhere, but it is really great. And I hope Criterion does a version of it. And it's not just like a silly comedy. It deals with like race relations in America in the 1950s while being a super fun, like poppy movie.
Mm-hmm. And it's totally a John Waters movie. Like I do feel like it comes off as a more mainstream friendly John Waters movie, but it's got some stuff that is just so him that, he's an auteur.
Yeah. There's a reason Criterion is giving him attention now.
Because they paid him.
Yeah. Like, it's not just weird, gross stuff. Like, even the weird, gross stuff is getting Criterion treatment because it comes from a place of, like, he's a big fan of Pasolini and a big fan of, who's the other guy? Because in Multiple Maniacs, his first feature film, you see scenes that are set in his apartment where he's living at the time, and he has, like, a Pasolini poster for one of his movies. And there's some other art European art film posters throughout his apartment. It's like, oh, this guy knows cinema.
This guy's a film. He's not
just some. Yeah, exactly. Look at his best of list every year. It's a lot of art films you've probably never heard of, and usually one or two like weird random movie. Like this last one was Mom and Dad, the Nick Cage movie, and a bunch of art films that I never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So like. You know, he's a.
We were a crybaby house for some reason when I was growing up. I mean, we also watched Hairspray, but for some reason I've seen Crybaby like 10 times at least.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe my sister had a crush on Johnny Depp. And...
Maybe. That's one of my favorite John Waters lines, which is Ricky Lake says to the girl and toss your titties the other way. let's see. And last one is Pedro Almodovar's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. It's his take on a film noir type story, but like kind of wacky, and it's not as transgressive and weird as his other ones can be. It's more this very interesting, kind of funny. Not kind of funny, like, it is a good movie. It's my, of the ones I've seen, it's the one I like the least, but still really solid. It won a Best Foreign Film Oscar. And, you know, Almodovar's, like, earlier stuff, I don't think, is given as much attention as later. But I think his stuff from the 80s should definitely be seen. And a lot of it is on Amazon Video right now. Including my favorite one, Dark Habits, his nun comedy, which is fucking phenomenal. And that's it.
All right. To cover the other thing, like, if you want to hear me talk about science fiction and fantasy movies with my co-host Aaron and Sarah, we've actually covered quite a few movies on Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space from the year 1988. And run through them real quick. We watched They Live, and that movie has become very important to all of us, which is crazy. I mean, it's a great John Carpenter movie. It's also a movie with a message that just keeps on being relevant. And Roddy Piper, he was amazing. Speaking of Roddy Piper, Hell Comes to Frogtown, which is bonkers, which is absolutely, if you like weird ass crazy movies and you haven't seen Hell Comes to Frogtown, you should watch that. And talking about it on the podcast was so much fun.
It's not good, but it's definitely worth your time.
It's not good. Roddy Piper is good in it. Once again.
So, yes. And Sandahl Bergman's good. Eh.
I was just going to say Sandahl Bergman. I'm not sure about it, but I mean, she's doing the best she can with the material, that's for sure. It's so crazy, though. I don't even want to describe it. Beetlejuice came out that year, another one. I shouldn't have to say anything about Beetlejuice, but I still think it holds up. Michael Keaton, a lot of fun in it. Willow, which was one of those movies that people told me does not hold up. Once again, they are incorrect. We watched Willow for the podcast, and I thought it was still a very fun adventure movie, like, well shot, well directed. Ron Howard did a really good job with George Lucas material, and it's a total Lord of the Rings ripoff, but that's fine because the characters and the actors are so awesome in it. Earth Girls Are Easy. I've, of course, had heard about that movie, but having seen it now, I wish I'd seen it earlier because I loved it when we watched it for the podcast. Like, it's kind of a musical, but seeing, you know, Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, Damon Wayans, and Jim Carrey goof off, and Julie Brown, of course, it's basically her creation, it's such a fun movie. Like, about, you know, aliens come to Earth and they're horny. What else do you need to know? Huh? Okay, sorry. And for one of our Summer of Love episodes, we watched the movie Young Guns, which is, I feel like that's a quintessential 1980s movie with all the young studs that they could get. You know, Emilio Estevez, Kiefer Sutherland, Lou Diamond Phillips, Charlie Sheen, and Dermot Mulroney looking like a gross homeless guy the entire time, which is great. But yeah, that's a weird movie that got made. But it doesn't have the Guns N' Roses song. That's in part two, apparently.
Oh, all right.
I was disappointed.
Yeah, Young Guns, I always heard of as a kid, but I don't think my Blockbuster had it. I'm not sure. But I was always aware of that one.
Blockbuster, when are you going to get Young Guns? Get out of here, kid.
Yeah, my Blockbuster was weird with their selection.
Yeah.
But, next episode will either be Losing Ground or Summer Sam. So
depends on what we can get recorded with. But look forward to the Summer of Sun episode. We're going to have some awesome guests.
Yeah. And the other 1999 movie will be Rosetta, the Cannes winner from that year, by the Dardenne brothers. I've heard of them, but I've never seen any of their movies.
Rosetta.
Yeah, and Oscar winner was American Beauty.
Yeah, we're not going to do that one.
I might watch it because I've never seen it.
Oh,
I just know about the scene that was parodied and everything with the plastic bag blown in the wind. And that's literally kind of all I know about it.
Yeah, you should watch it so that you can tell me what you think.
Yeah, I hear it doesn't age well, but...
Mm.
I don't know. And, let's see, coming up on... I don't know, check the Jailhouse 701 Japanese cult cinema, doing a trilogy of I guess they're considered the original Pinky Violence movies, but they're more historical action movies. Legends of the Poisonous Seductress. And I'm going to review that trilogy and that bunch of random assorted stuff coming up too. And that's it for me.
Yep.
No, did you have upcoming episodes of...
Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space? Yeah. I mean, just the same thing we had before. We have Mute. That should be out eventually, if I ever finish editing the thing. And then Incredible Mr. Limpet. We're going to be watching a movie called Hellgate that our listener paid us to watch. So, we're one of those people. You send us $20, hell yeah, we'll talk about whatever movie you want.
Yeah, so that's it. See you guys next time. I'm tired.
Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.